Hello, my name is Dr. Liz Burton-Crow, and I'm the Director of Education for the Carrillo Center for Nonviolence. Welcome back to Living One, our monthly webinar series where presenters from around the world share their vision of a future in which humans and other animals live as one community in peace and wellness. Given all that's unfolded in the past year, these conversations are more important than ever. For they are more than mere conversations. They are opportunities for building community, salve for the isolating wounds of our time. Through Living One, together we attempt to answer the question, we know it's wrong, but what does right look like? This month, we welcome Derek Jensen. He is hailed as a philosopher-poet of the environmental movement. He is the author of 27 books, including The Myth of Human Supremacy, Bright Green Lies, and A Language Older Than Words. He holds a degree in creative writing from Eastern Washington University, a degree in mineral and engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines, and has taught at Eastern Washington University and Pelican Bay State Prison. He has packed university auditoriums, conferences, and bookstores across the nation, stirring them with revolutionary spirit. And interviewing Derek today is our director of the Carrillo Center for Nonviolence, Dr. Gay Bradshaw.
Hi, everyone. And Derek, thank you so much for being here. And everyone, I hope all of you are staying cool, although there's probably a number of you enviably that are in cooler states and cooler climes, so we're jealous of you here on the West. Anyways, we're just really excited to have Derek here. Derek, I'm just going to jump in just to get people on sort of a pseudo page and also just to get your reflections. You know, you are the author of 25 plus books, which is extraordinary under themselves, and also in terms of the eagerness and the thirst with which readers and individuals are reading and wanting to listen to you. And I will say at the same time, although your writing is extraordinary, it truly is, you say a lot of things that people don't really like to hear and want to hear. So talk about that. Are there more people out there you think that really, really are thirsting for what you have to say?
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for having me. And before we start, I probably have to do this for this audience, but I want to acknowledge the importance of your own work to the world and to me. So I wanted to thank you for that. You know, when I started off, when I was a baby activist back in the late 80s and early 90s, it was my introduction to environmentalism was really through grassroots environmentalists, people who were filing timber sale appeals and doing, you know, filing lawsuits and doing whatever they could to protect this or that piece of ground. And I'm really glad that my introduction came through grassroots environmentalists instead of through theoretical environmentalists or sort of radical environmentalists, and the reason is because, well, I'm going to back up a second. And just the other day I interviewed an old school environmentalist, and it made me so happy because I love interviewing people, and I love talking to people whose love for the natural world is unalloyed and who will freely express this love of the natural world, and it's not mixed with, they don't, like, okay, so I interviewed someone several years ago, and this interview never played on my radio program because I didn't like what the person had to say so much. We were talking about a river, the Rio Grande, and she's a mainstream environmentalist, and she kept insisting many, many times that she says it's a myth that there is enough water for, no, she says it's a myth that there's not enough water for everybody. And my interview style is not very confrontational, so I didn't insist. It's like, if there's enough water for everybody, why are the fish going extinct, and why does the Rio Grande no longer reach the ocean? But what I did, I just never played the interview. It was a useless interview. And the point is, I interviewed this person the other day, and it was so lovely to just talk to somebody who cares more for the natural world than he does for the perpetuation of the society. And he cares, his love for them, and he recognizes that the human project has to reduce itself. It will reduce itself, whether we do it on purpose or not, it will reduce itself, because that's what happens when you're an overshoot. And it was just so delightful to talk to someone like that. And my point about when I was a baby activist is that those were the people I was surrounded with back then. Back in the 80s and 90s, environmentalism was still more, especially grassroots environmentalism, still more about protecting wild places and wild beings than it was about sustaining this culture. And there's been a transformation in the past 30 years, so that a lot of environmentalism has become about serving the culture instead of serving wild beings. And so the point is that I still remember the feeling I had when I was in the Spokane Public Library and the book The Natural Alien by Neil Everdon jumped off the shelf at me, because it was the first book I ever read that didn't take for granted the notion that the entire world was created for humans. And reading this book saved my sanity, and it saved my life and set me off on the path it has, along with other things. And so my point about all this is, when you live in a culture that's based on lies, it can be a tremendous gift to just read something that's true. And so there have been many activists and writers who have done that for me, and I'm hoping that I'm doing that for others. And there does seem to be an audience for this. I don't think it's as big an audience as Stephen King has, obviously, but there is an audience for there is a hole in discourse which I am attempting to fill, and basically just writing the books that I would love to read because I want to understand them. And that's a long-winded way of saying, yeah, there's not a lot of sort of, so we had a difficult time publishing Bright Green Lies, and we were casting about for publishers. And
this is your most recent book, just for the sake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we were casting about, and there was an industry insider who is retired. I mean, she's a big deal in the publishing industry, who's retired, and she was going to try to help my agent. She did try to help my agent find a publisher, and she kept making reports back to me, and she said, all these people, there are so many publishers. I tell them about your stuff, and they say, oh my God, don't tell anybody, but I really like his stuff. So privately they love it, but publicly, they can't so much, because there is it's not any sort of conspiracy or anything. It's like my friend George Jaffin says, you don't need a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same. And when your perspective is explicitly ecocentric and biocentric, that makes it really easy to like privately, but it goes against a lot of the public discourses. And so it can be a bit more scary to like it in public. And one last thing about this, which is, sometimes people call me courageous because I write this stuff. And I'm not really making a joke, that I'm not sure how much of it is courage and how much of it is simple social ineptness. Because I would rather, I write for the non-humans, and I write for the humans who are going to inherit the wreckage of what this culture is leaving behind. And one last thing about this, and this is the whole thing I find really interesting. People will say, oh my gosh, aren't you worried about what people will think about you? And it really falls into three categories. One is my friends, and they already know what I think, so it's fine. Second is a lot of people I'm never going to meet, so I don't really care what they think of me. And then the third group is I live in a really tiny town, Crescent City, and I go into the post office once a week, and I'm actually really concerned about what the people at the post office think about my work or the people at the grocery store, you know, that I see once in a while. I don't want them to go, oh, God, there's that crazy guy who. So I do have a little bit of social fear about the response to my work, but it's in a very, very small group of people. The ones who don't know me well enough to know it already, and the ones who, I mean, it's in between knowing me very well or not knowing me at all.
So I think it's really interesting about, you know, the industry person, you know, saying, well, don't tell him or don't tell anyone I really like his work. I think there's a lot of people like that. I've encountered that myself in sort of bizarre situations. You know, one was a prominent, you know, elephant scientist. He still is. And I asked him to sign on a letter, you know, having to do with stopping, I forgot what the hell it was. And, you know, he wrote me, he says, you know, wow, I just think your work is amazing. This is totally right, but I can't do it publicly. Even though he's seen as an, you know, one of the elephant advocates, and he gets money from industry, you know, for his research. So I think, you know, there are a lot of people. Another one was another time I published in a science kind of Reader's Digest, not really, kind of like bio. What was it? I can't say the name of it. But anyways, I published there, and my co-author was quite well known. And this editor kept calling me up at night saying, well, are you sure, you know, about, you know, I want to ask you these questions. And I'm like, wow, you know, it's like 3 hours later on the East Coast, you know. Finally, I said, do you call people like this? Well, it turns out later he was involved in doing experimentation on animals in labs before he became an editor of this journal. And I think that there is this, the reason I'm bringing those anecdotes up is because I think that maybe your books are really reaching those kinds of people who are frightened, people who are timid, people who have chosen the path more trod upon, right, but don't really believe in it. And in a sense, you know, perhaps your books are really helping fortify them as a collective resource for them in that way.
Well, I hope so. I mean, there's a line from a thriller novel that I just has always stuck with me, which is the first person through the door always gets shot. And, you know, there's the what was the, I don't remember what the Gandhi version of this was. It was something like, I don't know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they attack you, then you win or something. I'm probably completely butchering that.
That's some version of that. Yeah.
But it's, I think we need a multitude of voices, and we need, you know, I'm not sure with all the world at stake, with salmon going extinct, with, you know, 200 species a day going extinct, I'm not sure why it takes courage to talk about these issues. You would think that it would be the most common and obvious thing we would talk about, but it's not what I encounter. And yet, at least in my experience, which is not, you know, I run and, you know, in general and fairly, you know, probably not particularly normie crowds. But I found that a lot of times if you just raise the issue, people do want to talk about it. And, you know, it's not really possible to talk about discourse without talking about a couple of things. Right before we started recording and went on, I was talking to Liz, and I were chatting back and forth, and we were commenting a little bit about just how people are seeming to go even more and more crazy. And, you know, I've written in my books about how this culture is insane. I mean, it's killing the planet. You can't get any more insane than actually going, oh, the Arctic ice caps are melting. That will be great for international shipping. I mean, you can't get more insane than that. And so I've written about this for 20 some books, and then I am still somehow surprised when we collectively act crazy. It kind of makes me laugh. It's like I didn't even read my own books. Because I'm still surprised and shocked at this. But I've been heavily informed by the work of a lot of psychiatrists on how abusive dynamics play them out. And I've always had a pretty keen interest in how societies get themselves to do so many crazy things. And I love R.D. Lang's Three Rules of a Dysfunctional Family, which are also Three Rules of a Dysfunctional Culture. And Rule A is don't. And Rule A1 is Rule A does not exist. And Rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of Rules A, A1, or A2. So what this would mean within an abusive family is that you can talk about anything you want except for the violence that you all have to pretend isn't happening. And then, of course, you can't talk about the fact that you're not talking about the violence that you have to pretend isn't happening. And you can't talk about the fact that you can't talk about the fact that you can't talk about the fact and so on and so on. And on the larger scale, we can't talk about the, I used to, when I would give a lot of talks, I would ask the audience, do you think the government takes better care of individual human beings or corporations? And out of the tens of thousands of people collectively at all the talks, nobody, not a single one ever said that it takes better care of human beings. That's just crazy, but we talk about that a little bit, but not so much. And there are stolid scientists who are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish within less than 30 years now. And I don't know why we aren't running around screaming. And I don't remember who her name was. She was might still be alive. I don't know if she is. There was a endocrinologist or toxicologist from Western Canada who was really famous for writing about pollution. I can't remember her name. Anyway, she pretty consistently said her big thing was that we're bathing the world in endocrine disruptors. And it's like, how are we not? She would literally say, why are we not running down the street screaming about this every day, doing this huge open air experiment? And, you know, it's a bit glib, but I just keep coming back to sort of a collective insanity and a collective incapacity to, or another great example that your work has been so great about is there is so much evidence for non-human sentience, and yet we have to fight. I have to fight with every single publisher to say the tree who just got cut down, or you know, even the bear who is sitting outside the window. But especially with plants, the bacteria who basically run life on the planet, the insects who are being massacred en masse. There's this, so I have to fight with that, with even people who are publishing my books every single time. And yet the evidence for non-human sentience and non-human complexity and non-human communication is everywhere. So I love plants and I love how they interact. And a few months ago, I had some aphids on a plant, on some plants. So I took the plants outside and, excuse me, within about 2 hours, they were covered with various types of wasps who were eating the honeydew. And then within about a day, the plants were covered with these tiny, tiny wasps, about each one about the size of an aphid or maybe 1.5 times the size of an aphid. And who they are parasitic wasps who lay their eggs inside aphids and then they emerge kind of like that scene in Alien. And the thing that I find so cool is that where did those wasps come from? They were either smelling the aphids, or a lot of research suggests they were smelling signals put out by the plant saying, hey, we're being eaten by aphids. If you like aphids, come and get them. And I've witnessed this before, too. I remember I had a tree many years ago when I lived in Spokane that was covered with aphids one summer, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't do anything. And about a week or two later, the tree was absolutely covered in ladybug larvae, and the tree had called them in. And my point is, there's a line by Cleve Baxter. He said it to me back in the 90s that I just love, which is he said the measurement ability of science is becoming so fine and so refined that for not much longer will we be able to hold to the conceit that the rest of the world isn't sentient, because it's picking up on, we have the capacity to measure the pheromones released by plants, the pheromones released by animals as they communicate. You know, desert tortoises they navigate, they live in a rich world of scents, that rich world of smells that tell them, you know, where to go, what to eat. And I just, you know, I guess the thread that's running through everything so far for me is just that, you know, collectively there are these collective stories that we tell ourselves. And one of the primary collective stories is that non-humans are not subjective beings with lives as valuable to them as theirs is, as yours is to you and mine is to me. And a line I remember, I love about this is, I was 1992, actually Columbus Day 1992, I was interviewing Neil Everdon, who wrote The Natural Alien. And one of the things that I'm sorry about the question here, because I was still a baby at all this. He said that he doesn't believe in the sort of human significant, non-human insignificant boundary. And I said, well, if you're not going to draw the boundary there, where do you draw it? Do you draw it with, you know, human plant? Animal plant? Do you draw it with mammal reptile? Do you draw it with animal plant fungi? You know, where do you draw it? And he said this line that just was a tremendous feeling of homecoming for me, which was, why do you draw the line at all? And anyway, so we have this collective delusion that humans are the only ones who matter, and that leads us, now I'm going to back up and go a different direction. There was a line that was said about Hitler and the Holocaust that, from insane premise, this is a direct quote, from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. And the point is that if you have certain premises, then you can rationalize any behavior. And if one of your premises is that humans are significant, non-humans are insignificant, then you can certainly rationalize converting the entire planet into a parking lot and murdering the planet, as long as a few of us get to escape onto a pod and live in a jail cell on a interstellar spacecraft.
But isn't one of the, thank you for that, was wonderful. This is something that I encounter, and actually it's the topic the main topic of Living One, that there's all this information out there, and there's a significant number of individuals who are cranking out in kind of an industry more and more information. You know, now a baboon does this, knows how to paint their toenails purple. Oh, and so do pythons. So in other words, there's this cranking out of information. And really what seems to me is there's not a traction point on knowledge and doing. So I think one of the things that is, when you say people are screaming down the streets, you know, I kind of am one of the, what is his name? You know, the Norwegian, right? The silent scream, right? That's kind of me, is doing. So in other words, we have all this information. We have this knowledge, whether it's intellectual or whether it's visceral. I think one of the problems is what do we do? In other words, what do we do with this information? How do we integrate it in such a way that it actually throws a wrench into the works of this giant cog that is, in that example you're talking about, killing all the salmon? And I think there's a problem in terms of the doing. And so when there isn't that traction point of knowledge to do, you get that further kind of greasing of the wheels.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it won't surprise you that I have a whole bunch of answers.
Hence the question.
The first one is that the smartest decision I ever made was when I was about 24, living in North Idaho. And by the way, it's North Idaho, not Northern Idaho. If you ever go to North Idaho, because they want to secede. And if you ever go to North Idaho and you say, yeah, I'm up here in Northern Idaho, they'll all know that you're a foreigner. Anyway, so I was living in North Idaho, and capital N, capital I, by the way. And 24 and just not, I knew that everything was messed up. I knew that the world's getting killed, but I didn't know what to do because it's so big and so overwhelming and so despair-making that I didn't do anything. And then one day I realized that I wasn't paying enough for gasoline. At the time I was using maybe a tank a week, and a tank would cost about $10. So I decided that for every $10 that I spent on gas, I was going to give $10 to a local environmental organization to try to cover some of the social and ecological costs of gasoline. And so had I been doing this in your area, I would have given you $10 a week. Except I didn't have any money because I was an itinerant beekeeper and making almost no money. So what I did instead is I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. And so I started off by doing, you know, I did an anti-circus demo. I did an anti-fur demo. And I didn't let my ignorance, I just knew circuses were wrong. I didn't really know why. Didn't know anything, but I didn't let my ignorance, I love the line by Florence Nightingale that she said, I attribute my success to the fact that I never gave nor took an excuse. And I did not give myself any excuses. I don't care if I'm tired. I don't care if I'm sick. I don't care if I don't know what I'm doing. I am going to do 2 hours of activism this week. So I started off. I did an anti-circus demo. I didn't bring a sign. I showed up. Somebody handed me a sign. And I'm standing there. Circuses are bad. And then some guy came up really mad and said, why are circuses bad? And I said, I don't know. Ask the guy next to me. He knows more than I do. You know, it's like, it's all fine. I just jumped in. I did anti-fur demos. I did some anti-military demos. The demos were pretty useless, frankly, but it was a good start. I mean, if you're going to stand around talking with a friend, why don't you hold a sign while you're doing it? It's no big deal. Anyway, and then I moved on from there to doing letters to the editor, and I was so scared at first. I didn't let my fear stop me. I was so scared at first that I didn't sign my own name to any of them. So I would write them under all sorts of pseudonyms because I didn't want anybody to know that, oh, my God, logging is bad. And, so things have moved, obviously, from there. I gained some courage. And then I started doing some timber sale appeals. And before I knew it, I was having so much fun that I stopped keeping track of hours. So the point is that as my friend Leah Keith says, who's, I think, here. Yeah, she's here. The big divide is not between those who want to bring down civilization and those who don't. The big divide is between those who do something and those who do nothing. So my big thing is to start doing something. And I can't tell people what to do. And the reason I can't tell people what to do is because I don't know what your gifts are and I don't know what your proclivities are. You know, a lot of people have said, Derek, you've written all these books, but you need to stop writing books and you need to become an organizer because that's what's really needed. And it's like, I am not, okay, here's my scratch paper organization. I am not an organizer. I have certain gifts. I have certain facilities. There are certain things I love to do, and there are certain things I don't love to do. Oh my God. So I was working with this environmental organization in Spokane back when I lived there. One night, I'm such an introvert. One night they asked me to help them by being on a phone tree, making cold calls to people in the organization to tell them about a dinner we were having. So I'm not even doing something bad. I'm not asking for money. I'm saying, do you want to come to dinner? I spent the entire evening on the phone bank dialing six numbers of a seven-number phone number and then completely freaking out, being utterly incapable of dialing the seventh number. I did not call a single person that night. I stink at that. Another time we did a door hanging. I went with two other people, and I'm such an introvert that they would walk down the street. They would walk up to somebody's door and hang the information on their doorknob. And I would stand on the sidewalk because I was terrified to walk up to the door in case somebody opens it. On the other hand, I have talked to an audience of 10,000 people, and I wasn't nervous at all. I think it's because I was a teacher for many years. The point is, there are things you can do and things you can't. I had a friend who several years ago, I'm just call up to chat. I say, hey, what are you doing? So, well, I'm kind of bored today, so I'm going to go down in front of Walmart and leaflet. I'm like, this is hell. I cannot imagine something I would hate worse than like accosting people I don't know and handing them some pieces of paper they don't want. And yet that was how she was going to spend her Sunday. So we have different proclivities or organization itself. You know, I'm fine. Like even the organization that I'm a co-founder of, DGR, you know, I'm good at sort of keeping us on track philosophically, and I'm good at having, you know, heart-to-heart talks with some of the people in it and encouraging them and praising them when they do wonderful things. I'm good at all that, but like organizing or, oh, we have to get organizational insurance, call the insurance agent and work out all the, it's like, I can't. I can barely balance my checkbook, which is a nice way of saying I can't balance my checkbook. It's really important to figure out, well, first off, figure out what you love. And no matter what you love, it's under assault. So I say, I can't tell people what to do, but I can ask them these questions. First off, what do you love? And I have a friend who is just desperately in love with prairie dogs. And she, for a long time or for a while, like we all do, she said, oh, I'm really sad about what's going on with the prairie dogs. And that only lasted so long. And then she's like, okay, now I need to do something. And she works to get them to get prairie dog colonies not poisoned. And she also works to relocate the ones that they can't stop from being poisoned. So if they're going to put in a shopping mall and she can't stop the shopping mall, she will try to relocate them. So she does that great work. And that just fills me with so much happiness that she's doing that work. Horror that she has to do it, but happiness that she's doing it. So first off, what do you love? And it can be women's rights. It doesn't have to be a non-human. It can be women's rights. It can be long-form thinking. I am horrified at how long-form thinking is being destroyed. We need to have books that can take us through an idea for 400 pages. And we need to have conversations that last for weeks as opposed to having a soundbite. okay, don't get mad at me because of the issue, because the point is not the issue. I don't care whether it's Black Lives Matter, Make America Great Again, I don't know, or any other slogan like that. You can't discuss significant political issues, significant philosophical issues, with three or four words. And what the hell does Make America Great Again mean? What the hell does Black Lives Matter mean? Which black lives are they talking about? And don't get mad at me for that, because the whole point is the slogan. And I am a, and long form thinking is under assault. Independent bookstores are under assault. Back when Crescent City, where I live, still had an independent bookstore, I committed to and followed through on the commitment to buy one book a month from him, because I wanted to support, I wanted to put my money where my mouth is in terms of supporting an independent bookstore, because they are being destroyed by Amazon, or have been destroyed by Amazon. So find what you love, and what you love could be humans 150 years from now, because they're going to hate us for what we have done to the planet, and presuming they're still alive. And so find what you love, and then defend it. Just do something and start small. Do an hour a week, and then it becomes 2 hours a week, and then it eventually becomes your whole life. And that's one question. What do you love? The next question is, what do you love to do? And, you know, I love trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. Instead of what do you love, because what do you love is like, oh, I love walks on the beaches and romantic nights in front of a fireplace. And that's, it's too personal as that. Instead, sorry about the sort of vulgarity, but what do you get off on doing? And what I get off on doing is trying to figure out what I just said, or what I've been working on recently for a book I'm working on right now is, we always hear, we understand that trauma stories must be hidden. So if the, we will not attend. There's the R.D. Lang's Three Rules of a Dysfunctional Family. And there's also this great experiment by this guy in his 60s, Lester Laborsky, where he attached electrodes to people's eyeballs and he would track where they would look. And what he found is if you gave the person something, like a piece of paper that had something that threatened their worldview on it, their eyes would not even track to it once. So they would see it out of the corner of their eye and know not to look at what would mess with their worldview. And a great example of this that happened right when I was reading about that is there was a guy in the DEA in Colombia whose wife was doing lines of cocaine in front of him, and he would walk through the room and not see it. And now we can argue, yeah, that they were both trying to protect him from, you know, getting arrested too, because he was importing cocaine to the United States. But I think this is actually real. I mean, I don't know if I'm the only person who's ever been in a really crappy relationship. And if anybody says, you know, this relationship has this or this problem, I'm like, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? And then afterwards, like, oh my God, how do they not see that? Well, the point is we know where not to look. And why did I bring all that up? Because right now in the book I'm working on, I'm discussing, I understand why so often stories of trauma are hidden, because they can be really painful to try to metabolize and to work your way into or through. I understand all that really well. But there's another part of this, which is that the trauma stories will be told, and they'll be told either in action or told in some sort of healing context. And for the last, like, month, I've been really like a dog chewing on a bone about, so why must we tell the story? And the point is, I get off on that. This, you know, I've condemned myself to a life of homework. And other people, you know, get off on doing certain, my friend got off on going to Walmart and handing out leaflets about how Walmart's terrible. And so if you are doing, I mean, there's that old cliche about, if you're doing what you love, you never work a day in your life. And so if you can find what you get off on doing, you won't get burned out. if they put me in as a job as an organizer, as the executive director of an organization, I would get burned out in a month because I just would hate it. But I love writing, which is why I've got so many books. Okay, and the third question. So what do you love? What do you get off on doing? And the third one is, what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? What gifts do you have? I mean, there are people who have gifts for computer programming. I'm not one of them. There are people who have gifts for accounting. Oh, my God, you know, organizations need accountants, and I'm not one of them either. And so find out what your gifts are, and then use them in the service of the plan base. And then the entire other direction I wanted to take this is that so far as what we do, that's on a small sort of tactical scale. On the larger strategic scale, excuse me, I think there are many layers to this. And the first layer is, back when I was a baby grassroots environmental activist, all the other grassroots activists with whom I was working were basically holding on by their fingernails, trying to protect Selkirk caribou or bull trout or this or that piece of land, basically holding on by their fingernails until civilization collapses, because they recognize that this culture is going to just continue to grind away until there's nothing left. And so one level of thing that we have to do, I think, is to work proactively to stop the grinding of the machine on the planet. That's one area, because if it doesn't stop, it will kill everything on the planet. Another thing I think is really important, excuse me, is to defend wild places and wild beings. Defend a particular place you like, or defend particular species you like. Defend larger areas. Defend habitat, because that's what they need is habitat. So what non-humans need, humans need too. Another area is attempting to change the culture, which we've been talking about throughout this conversation. Another area I think is really important is to a book I'm going to write a couple books down the road is going to be about feeding non-humans, because I feel very strongly that non-humans are refugees in their own land, and we need to do what we can to help them survive until this culture is done. And that includes habitat, and it can also include feeding them. And feeding them is a really interesting case, and this is one reason I want to explore this in this book, is because I keep wondering, like, let's just take one example, raccoons. If one were to feed raccoons, that helps the raccoons. And the question I always come back to is, do more raccoons help the forest itself? And I think in some cases, yes. And in some cases, no. I mean, we know that, raccoons will eat ground-dwelling birds. So how, you know, where do the ground-dwelling birds fit into this? And I want to explore all those questions of, you know, doesn't matter what animal, whether it's a squirrel, a raccoon, a bear, or a plant. You know, feeding plants, does that, you know, I just want to dive into the complexity of that question. But I do think that that's an important thing to do, is whether you act as a refuge or a sanctuary or a feeding station. It doesn't matter. That I think what we have, the important thing is the transfer of our loyalty away from the system and I've been talking about non-humans collectively as, you know, as biomes, as, you know, protecting a place. And I think that's desperately important, but there's also, okay, so I'll just give an example. There's a a local bear here who a couple years ago ended up with some sort of infection in his hind leg and hind legs, and his entire back end swelled up about twice normal size. Yeah, probably 1 3/4 to twice normal size. His back legs were huge. His testicles were huge, all just swollen. And I had some Cipro hanging around, and this is illegal, but I don't care. I put some Cipro into peanut butter sandwiches and threw them out and gave him that for 4 or 5 days, and then he was fine. And my point is, I know it's some law on the internet that the first person who mentions Hitler loses, but I've already mentioned Hitler once, already lost, so I'm going to go again. That is, if I were living in Nazi Germany, I would hope that I would have helped the internal refugees, you know, Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, Russians. I would hope I would have done that. And we have the opportunity to do that now. If you live in a city, if you live in the country, it doesn't matter that there are non-humans. I mean, it just kills me that we collectively wipe out the salmon, and then we get mad when bears beg. It's like, what do you want them to do? You took away their food source. And I was just talking to somebody a few days ago who, I took a contrarian perspective on this too from long ago, and this environmentalist I was talking to did too, that he thought driving the grizzly bears out of the dumps at Yellowstone was a terrible idea. It's like, you take away their food sources, of course they're going to find another food source. And now because, I don't know why exactly, but they, and then you kick them out of another food source. So what? The food can just rot in the ground? I mean, non-humans are refugees, and I think we need to do what we can. And then the other thing I think is really important. So it's basically, that's like being a combat medic or a combat nurse, that, you know, we need to help whomever we can, wherever we are. And then, the other thing I think that's really important is to do whatever you can to take land that's been harmed, land who has been harmed, and either restore it or, let it restore itself. So that's what I think we should do.
I have a comment, if I might, about the one before, which is providing food for the refugees. Where we live here, we spend hundreds of dollars a month for years and years and years and years providing for the wildlife, specifically deer, raccoons, skunks, foxes, bears, cougars, you name it. And of course, all of this is illegal in the agencies, you know, as I've written about in my books, the jail, et cetera, et cetera. And my experience in wild turkeys, and my experience is they are refugees. And I've actually used that term, they're refugees in their own home. And they don't eat the food unless they want it. The food that we give them and we serve them is far below, from a nutrition point of view, it's far below what they really need. But it's the only thing we can afford. You know, in terms of being able to give the amounts that they need, they are desperate. And right now they have no water. As I mentioned, there's a lake. I mean, there's a dam, but there's a river. Our creek is up, but people are very hostile. I just learned, for example, this is not quote unquote wildlife, but the city of Ashland, I was called to take in a rooster. The reason why is because this woman and her family moved from, out of state to Ashland, which is very she, it has the Shakespeare Festival. And there's an ordinance which bans roosters. Now, a rooster is not a raccoon, but, you know, there's such a culture of fear and loathing about animals. And, you know, there was a UPS or FedEx person that stopped by, a really nice young man, and, you know, he brought some, you know, something for rabbit litter the other day. And he goes, you know, I was really worried. He said, because we get throngs of deer. They are literally starving. They are starving. And we buy them greens, et cetera. And he said, I was really nervous. He said, are these deers okay? They came really up close to me and everything. I said, they're fine. He was terrified that they were going to be attacked. People have been a quote unquote attacked in Ashland by deers. Why? For the very reasons that you're talking about. People water their lawn, they have all sorts of beautiful flowers, and they get upset when the deer go in there, or the deer have babies And they're very nervous about having humans around because humans hunt, humans get rid of them, humans do stupid things, etc. The underlying thing is all wildlife, and I will make that a blanket statement because, you know, in particular, this is of interest to you. All wildlife, by a scientific definition, of which scientists, wildlife biologists will not admit, but by a scientific neuroscience perspective, all wildlife are severely traumatized. Year after year, they witness, they are shot at, they witness their family, their friends being shot, they live in a, someone called it a landscape of fear. So I really applaud that. And to me, I don't think it's necessary to overthink, you know, oh, are we disturbing the eco? The ecosystem is so effing messed up that it really doesn't matter. It comes down to pure, just being decent and caring and sharing. And I spend a lot of time, this sort of peripatetic running around. Oh, I hear, you know, the ravens out there. So I go out and give to the ravens because they're having babies. You know, we had a swallow's nest. These are old swallow's nests that my parents put up years ago. Well, they're frying. They would be frying alive in this, bizarre heat wave we're having. So I put water on it, which is very extravagant because I'm very mindful of water. So I just want to really emphasize and underscore this notion of that we have a planet of refugees. And I do think it's incumbent upon us to really care about them. I mean, it doesn't mean to be stupid about it. You have to think about what is the correct kind of food for them. But you don't need to overthink it. You know, they won't eat what they don't need. I have this stuff I call, it's called no waste, and it's chopped up peanuts and chopped up sunflower seeds and stuff. And I give it to the wild turkeys. Well, if they don't want it and need it, they go off. And they're, you know, picking off the seeds in the fields and all. So I really appreciate you, you know, bringing attention to the fact that we live amongst refugees. And they can't, quote unquote, take care of themselves anymore because they don't have anything. Their cultures are traumatized and shattered. If you look at any kind of population, it looks like ours. It's kind of horizontal. And they're values and ethics are changing because they don't have elders. So we're looking at very, very disrupted communities and traumatized. And so one of the things that we can do is to give them some of the basics in order to survive and thrive and feel some kind of security and safety in the place that they're living, where they are able to have recharge psychologically as well as philosophically and psychologically, physiologically and culturally. So
I completely
a long comment that I couldn't hold my tongue.
I completely agree with you. And so far as a place to recharge, one of the things that makes me, this is one of the top two or three things in my life that makes me happy, is when I see bears sleeping on the porch so soundly that they're snoring.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me happy that here is a place that they know they can be comfortable enough that they don't, that they can completely let their guard down. So I completely agree with you about being traumatized. And there's a story, the guy who wrote, Charles Frazier, who wrote, Dark Mountain, is the most famous one. He also wrote a book called 13 Moons, which was really interesting. It was a love story between a man and a woman that I did not find particularly compelling, but it was also a love story between the man and the land where he lived, which I did find extremely compelling. And it's set in North Carolina from 1820 to 1900. And so it starts off with wolves. Buffalo have just been driven out of North Carolina. And then through his life, by the end of his life, the forests are gone, the animals are gone, and he has this wonderful soliloquy right near the end where he's living next to train tracks with trains going by of tourists going west and trees going east every day. And everyone he ever loved has died because he's very old. And he reflects on the fact that we evolved getting old and dying. And we evolved losing those we love. You know, it is natural. My mom died 2.5 years ago and I'm still devastated, but we evolved to lose our parents and we evolved to lose our older siblings and we evolved to lose our friends one by one. And that just happens. And what we didn't evolve with is having natural communities falling apart around our ears. So we did not evolve. We evolved. Okay. The individuals in your life may die, but the forest remains and the salmon still run up the stream every year. That you can count on. We did not evolve to be able to hold the grief of, yes, individual trees fall down and more trees come up, but we did not evolve such that the entire forest went down. And it's not just us. I mean, yes, there is the traumatization for the non-humans, by which I'm including plants, by the way, and rocks, for that matter, and rivers. There is the traumatization of the individual injuries. I'll just be honest, and that's not the only bear to whom I've ever given antibiotics. I've given bears antibiotics after they've been shot or caught in traps, too. And so there is the individual trauma of seeing your sibling shot or seeing your child shot or your parent shot or being chased and hated constantly. There is that trauma. There is also, as you said, the trauma of losing cultural bonds. For example, last year, a male bear killed a baby bear. No, 2 years ago. Yeah, 2 years ago. And so I started doing some research on that, and it ends up in some places, the male bears will kill up to like 40 or 50% of the cubs, and in a Finnish study, and they do that to bring the mother into heat. And that seemed like a tremendous waste of the mother's time and energy. Evolutionarily, why would they waste so much of her time? I understand this from just the male perspective, having your genes passed on instead of other ones. And then I found this thing. It seemed like this can't be just a typical part. I don't understand why this isn't counter-evolutionarily productive. And then I learned female bears have territories. Males, for the most part, don't. Males just hang out and do whatever they want. But it ends up that if you have basically a single male who has an overarching territory, he will keep the other males in line and will not. So this is not a normal state. When this happens, the Finnish study, they realized at the end that it was because there was a lot of hunting that was killing, basically, I hate this term, but killing the alpha males. And so the other males were acting poorly. Nobody was telling them, hey, cut this crap out. And the rate of child killing is much, much, much lower when you have a stable bear society. So yes, they're traumatized individually, they're traumatized culturally, and they're also, the whole point of this long rant here, is they're also traumatized ecologically.
I have to insert here that when I was, again, I don't mean to talk about my work, but when I was doing the Carnivore Minds book and I was looking into infanticide, and this was a prevalent assertion among pumas, and also there was this big primate study showing about, you know, if you all recall, the, you know, people who have worked with me know the story, but, you know, Passion and Palm and the Gombe, and it was really shocking. I think it was in the 70s when a mother and a child, a chimpanzee, were killing and cannibalizing others, and it was da da da. So primates have always been used as, this was in Gombe, and it was happened elsewhere. So this whole concept of infanticide has been a main thrust in science for a long time. Well, it turns out, and this wasn't my work, there's a professor who studies the anthropology of war at Rutgers. And when you look at the data, he said, it just doesn't hold. In other words, this whole notion of infanticide, for example, at Gombe, really could have been attributed to they were moving and putting in banana stations, the researchers at Gombe. So they were changing things in a fundamental kind of a way. Something that he had not thought of was, and of course I'm, you know, the trauma hammer looking for the nail, right? Was all of these places. And if you look at the scientists who are doing all of this work, it is post-colonial, right? So you're talking about these places that have been colonized and that have gone through successive, massive genocide, slaughter, and disruption before the real onset of quote-unquote modern science. And when you look at the infanticide literature, like in the Puma, it doesn't exist, but people have developed their careers on that. So this whole notion that you were bringing up about the bears, you know, Charlie Russell spoke about that. You know, it was ridiculous. It is ridiculous. So in other words, this is one of the major myths which has been imposed on by a particular agency, meaning science, post-colonial science, so that the onset, the data baseline starts after hundreds of years of massive disruption, death, and slaughter. So we're looking at, when we look at populations that are around, that are acting normal, we're looking at a tremendous kind of resilience, an ethical and philosophical kind of resilience, which animals, non-humans, I also will include plants and rocks and everything, they seem to have developed a very powerful ability and capacity to refrain, which we have not. And before you disappear, I've got to ask you one more question and then you can circle back and answer more. What is the vision? This is again the topic. What do you see? I know you say you don't like to tell people things, but what is the vision toward which you think as a species we should be working toward? How should we learn to live? Not just right now, but what is that quote unquote goal vision? What does it look like?
I want to say one more thing about the trauma before we move on, which is that
you can circle back and say more.
one of the points that I have made for a long time is you would not do sociological studies of people living in death camps or people fleeing, you know, refugees fleeing the Nazi panzers in Russia in World War II, you wouldn't do sociological studies of them and presume that that means anything about stable human behavior. You would presume that that study shows you what humans are like in death camps or fleeing from an invading force. So at this point, why would we think that any study we do of chimpanzees or bears or redwood trees would teach us anything about how they live normally? I'm just saying what you said in a different way.
Mm-hmm. No, right.
So that's the first thing. So far as the vision, that's why I brought up the whole civilization thing. You know, when people think of Iraq, is the first thing they think of cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. Because that's what it was prior to the beginnings of this culture. The first written myth of Western civilization is Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq to make a great city. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. I think it was Plato or Aristotle, one of those old dead guys, was
Heraclitus? What? Was it Heraclitus?
No, it was either Plato or Aristotle. No, it's Plato, I think. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It was some old dead guy. Was complaining that that deforestation in ancient Greece was harming water quality. And I have absolutely no doubt that the equivalent of the ancient Greek Department of Environmental Quality said we need to study this problem for a few years and make sure there's a correlation. North Africa was heavily forested. Those forests were cut down to make the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. All the islands in the Mediterranean, somebody wrote to me a couple years ago to say, we always think that they're rocky, but that's not true. before the rocks were where they're supposed to be, which was under soil. They were heavily forested. The point is, oh, there were penguins. The reason there are no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere is because they were wiped out. They were called great auks, and they weren't actually penguins, but they were, they did the ecological function. They were wiped out in the 19th century. The point is, this culture, forests precede us and deserts dog our heels. And we can make all the changes we can, and we can feed all the wild animals and plants we can. And that's really great. But as long as you're in the superstructure that is inherently destructive, this culture will continue to grind away. I'm not saying we shouldn't do anything in the meantime. In the meantime, it is even more important to protect every scrap of wild place. But that doesn't alter the fact that as long as this culture continues, it will continue to destroy life on the planet because it's based on it. We can talk about this sociologically, psychologically, and on the level of resource movement. You know, it's a zero-sum game. As John Livingston said, there is no surplus in nature. Everything you take from wild nature is food somebody else doesn't get. So I cut down a tree and burn it. That's a tree that if I lived on the East Coast or in the Midwest, fireflies could eat as it decomposed. But now they don't get to. I'm not saying don't consume anything. I mean, you're an animal. You consume things. Get over it. You know, so am I. And we need to get over the fact that we do consume things, but we need to recognize that two things. One is, so I got in a big fight with this guy one time because he said that because I use toilet paper, I'm just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense to me. But I took a walk through the forest and I asked a tree. So, I mean, because it's a tree, I mean, could be turned into toilet paper. So I asked the tree, what, you know, am I as culpable for deforestation as CEO of Weyerhaeuser? And the tree said to me, you're an animal, you consume things, get over it. But you need to understand the fundamental predator-prey relationship, which is if you consume the flesh of another, and it doesn't matter whether the flesh is of a salmon or a tree, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation and the dignity of the other's community. And everybody knows this. Bears know that if they eat all the salmon in the river, they will not have any food for the future. And you don't survive. And that is an evolutionarily counterproductive measure. This is something that kills me. We've been taught that evolution is based on natural selection, which of course it is. But we've also been taught that natural selection is based on hyper-competition, like the selfish gene. And I can disprove that in one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons, which is, those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. So long as we're living in this way of life that systematically and functionally destroys habitat, habitat will be destroyed. So my vision for the future is... So, do you want the bad news first or the good news first?
You choose.
Okay, the bad news is we're not going to have televisions and refrigerators.
We're not going to have Zoom. Oh, no.
Yeah. Because those are functionally unsustainable, which I can talk about if you want me to. But the good news is that humans have lived... The Talawa lived where I live now for 12,500 years. And this is not romantic, noble, savage crap. I'm not saying they were perfect. They were certainly not perfect. But I do know that there were about 10 to 12 to 14,000 people lived here for 12,000 years. And when the Europeans arrived, the Klamath was still black and roiling with fish. And so the bad news is we have to give up on our gadgets collectively. But we won't give up on our gadgets, which means the whole thing's going to collapse. And all of my work is about understanding that this way of life won't last. And when it's over, I would prefer that there's more left of the natural world rather than less. That's it. That's 25 books right there. And And what would it look like? One thing it would look like is it would be local, because one lives to, how far do you live from my house? What, like 80 miles? 70 miles as a crow flies?
Maybe 100. I don't know.
But it would be different to live even there than here, because mm-hmm. you're having a heat wave, and a heat wave here is when it gets over 70. And one would live differently in a temperate rainforest than how one would live in the desert of Arizona. And so the only ways of life that have ever been sustainable are local ways where the religion is based on the local area, where the customs, I guess that comes under religion, is based on the local area. And it doesn't take more than that land can give into perpetuity. And so the way ultimately that I see us living, okay, so years ago, 30 years ago, now God, I'm getting old. 30 years ago, I was riding in a car with my friend George Drafin, and we were stuck in traffic in Seattle. And I'm just making conversation, passing time while we're bumper to bumper. Oh, don't you love that cartoon that has all these people stuck in traffic? And the caption is, "Those damn environmentalists want to ruin our way of living." Anyway, so we were all stuck in traffic. And I say to George, "So, George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be?" And George was in a really bad mood, and he said to me, "Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we'll be living there again someday, and the only question is what's left of the world when we get there." So, I mean, do I like hot showers? Yeah. Do I like listening to Beethoven on a stereo system? Yeah. But those aren't sustainable. And I want to tell a quick story about this that just sort of breaks it down really fast. I was getting interviewed by this guy. He wrote for Nature magazine. And I was getting interviewed by him, and he was a dedicated Marxist who believed that it was possible to have industrial society, global industrial society, with purely voluntary exchanges. And I said, "Okay, great. Do you live in cities?" He said, "Yep." I said, "Great. How do you get around in the city?" He said, "Buses." I said, "Great. What are your buses made of?" He said, "Metal." I said, "Great. Where do you get the metal?" He said, "From a mine." I said, "Great. How do you get people to work in the mine?" He said, "You just pay them a lot." I said, "Well, there's real problems with that, because mining is such a horrible way to live that it was one of the first forms of slavery, but I'm going to give that one to you. You can just pay them a whole bunch to destroy their lives living underground and then die early deaths from, you know, asbestosis or something, or silicosis. Anyway, I said, "I'll give you that one. But what do we do with the fact that every single hard rock mine that has ever existed pollutes groundwater and pollutes rivers?" He said, "Well, what's the problem?" "The problem is you write for Nature magazine." I said, "The problem is that there are humans," because clearly you don't care about non-humans, "but there are humans who live next to the river. What do you do about them?" He says, "You pay them to move." I said, "They're not going to move, because they've been living there for 5,000 years. Their ancestors are buried there, and they won't leave their ancestors." He said, "You just paid them a whole bunch of money." I said, "No, they will not move. This is their home, and it has been for 5,000 years. He said, "Well, how many of them are there?" I said, "What difference does it make? There's 500. He said, "Well, the people in the city vote, and the million people vote that those 500 people have to leave the river so that they can put in the mine, so they can have..." I said, "So what you're telling me is you've gone from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, land theft from indigenous people, and probably genocide, all so you can have a bus. And you did this in less than a minute." And so the point is, we need to understand that it doesn't matter what it is. Solar panels don't come from the solar panel tree, and televisions don't come from, you know, the television pumpkin. And there are consequences to all of these things. So the way of life is going to have a lot fewer humans, because we've exceeded carrying capacity. And I want to be really clear that every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation. If I were like dictator of the planet, I would say, okay, first off, no more retractable stadium roofs. And I even like sports. No more retractable stadium roofs, no more golf courses, no more lawns. And then, you know, and then I'd work the things that are a little bit harder as we go on. Like right now, the world's commercial fishing fleets are subsidized to a greater value than their entire catch. So we would all be better off if they would pay those people the same amount of money to stay home in their underwear and watch The Price is Right and leave the fish alone. We'd all be better off. It's cheaper. It's like, it's the same thing with National Forest timber sales. You know, they're money losers. So I would just switch a lot of the subsidies for a while, and I would try to have a slow crash. As I think it was John Michael Greer said, the long, slow descent. I would try to do that, switch over, you know, money from the military to wildlife rehabilitation and restoration. But it's not going to happen. Every cell in my body wants for it to be a voluntary transformation. But if it's not going to be, and we all know it's not going to be, then what does that mean for our strategy and for our tactics? And one of the things, I mean, that makes it all the more important to protect every scrap of land, to protect every well-being. You know, I thought about this with the bears, too, in terms of, you know, females have territory. So when bears hang out around here, I'm really helping one female and like six or seven males. And males are kind of irrelevant reproductively because, you know, one male and seven females, you can have seven babies, and seven males and one female, you still have one baby. But then, you know, there's also that neurological disease that's going through California right now. And we don't know which male bears might carry immunity to it. This is one reason. I've interviewed George Werthner about this several times. This is one reason he's so furious about all of the logging that's, quote, to improve forest health, because the trees will get sick and then they cut down all the trees. But that's, you're cutting down the trees who might have had immunity to it. And that actually is one, that was a huge thing with the chestnut blight. You know, chestnut blight wiped out chestnuts all over the American Southeast and East. But that isn't what really did them in. What really did them in is after the chestnut blight came through and killed them, loggers came through and killed the trees who were left, the trees who had been immune to it. So what is my vision? My vision is small scale, humans living in small-scale communities, land-based communities, as they have done for almost all of our existence on the planet, which unfortunately does not mean that we get to watch television for 8 hours a day. Unfortunately, may or may not be ironic there. So that's my vision, and a lot of humans don't particularly like it. But I can guarantee that prairie dogs who hear this perspective respond by going, yep, yep, yep. And, you know, this is the way to think about this is, if you were a Delta smelt, or if you were a blue whale, or if you were a black bear, a grizzly bear, a redwood tree, it doesn't matter, and you could communicate in such a way that the humans were hearing you, what would they tell you to do? And, I mean, for one thing, they would say, we need help. And another thing they'd say is, for the most part, leave us alone. You know, when you're not helping us, leave us alone. And they would also say, civilization is killing the planet. And it all... Everything becomes very clear to me when I look at it from the perspective of the Klamath River. I mean, that's part of the thing. People will say, how can we help salmon to survive? But that's not the question they're asking. When they say, how can we help salmon to survive? They're generally saying, how can we help salmon to survive without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without taking out the dams, without stopping global warming, without stopping the murder of the planet? And the answer is you can't.
No free lunch.
No free lunch. And it's really a matter of values, you know. I simply value life on the planet more than I value. So I interviewed this guy 20 years ago. It was really disappointing. He had written some really good stuff against civilization and how civilization is inherently unsustainable. So I went to interview him. I didn't know that he had just written another book in which he had changed his mind completely. So I interview him, and this never got published. I interview him, and what happened is he had open heart surgery, and because modern medicine saved his life, he now thought civilization's a great thing. And again, because I'm not, I just didn't publish the interview, but because I'm not a confrontational interviewer, I didn't say to him, how it benefits you is no means by which you should judge a social system. For crying out loud, if that's the case, give me 3,000 slaves, because that'll sure as hell benefit me. Doesn't necessarily benefit them, but who cares?
Yeah.
And one can accept. See, okay, so I got really mad at some Buddhists back 16 years ago because I would be talking about how much I love the salmon, and some Buddhists would come up to me and say, you need to learn non-attachment because you need to learn not to care about the salmon because the salmon are just twitching of God's eyebrows and they'll be gone. And I would always turn that around and say, let's say it's somebody you love. Let's say somebody's torturing your child right now or your parent or your friend or your lover. They're torturing them right now. Do you say, well, they were just going to die eventually anyway, so it's just the twitching of God's eyebrows? No, if you love them, you try to defend them. But what I realized is that they had, one of these days I'll work out a really clever way to say this, but it just occurred to me. They had an attachment disorder about attachment or something, and they had disordered attachment. There's a clever way to say it, but I don't know what it is. But the point is, they were attached to the wrong thing. Because first off, you shouldn't be attached to non-attachment. Second, yes, we should be attached to whether salmon have something, are alive, but what we should be non-attached to is the modern transportation system. Sure, I will drive to the store because it's how it works, but I'm not attached to it, and when it goes, that's good. And same with modern medicine, you know? I'm reliant on modern medicine for my life, but my life is not the point. The point is life on the planet. I mean, I'm gonna die anyway, so ultimately, it doesn't matter if I die a little bit sooner. If that makes it so the planet's in better shape, then
you should have yanked. You should have yanked them with that. Say, what about the Eightfold Path? That would have stopped them in their tracks.
So it was pretty cool. I had two Zen Buddhists come up to me after a talk one time. A Zen Buddhist priest and a Zen Buddhist nun, and I was like, and they're all dressed, you know. So I'm like. And they said, we're Zen Buddhist priests and nuns. I'm like, oh, crap, here it goes. They're going to go after me. And they said, you know, any Zen Buddhist worth their salt would agree with everything you said about this. But the problem is that we can – here's the problem is that I think most of our philosophy and most of our religion and most of our energy goes toward rationalizing what we wanted to do in the first place. Mm-hmm. And those particular Buddhists, those other Buddhists were simply using – their Buddhism as an excuse to rationalize not doing anything to help the salmon.
Thank you so much. We could go on and on. I would love to go on, but I'm getting a signal that there are some questions and comments.
Great. Let's go to them.
Share the stage. I'm sorry. I was dominating it.
Thank you.
As you know from our previous conversations, I love chatting with you. It's great.
I am sure that there are some questions in the audience. So if you would like, you can feel free to unmute yourself, or if you feel more comfortable with me reading your question, you can go ahead and put it in the chat box and I'll be happy to read that out loud for you. So is there anyone who had a first question?
There was a lady from England who wrote a note saying that she loved your interview, Derek, but she had to go to bed. So.
No takers first up?
Well, I'm going to say two good things then, because I just want to say how much and how important the work of Lierre Keith, who's here, and also Mary Nelson, who's here, how important they are to me.
Thank you for that. And I do see quite a few people in the room who similarly have had a profound influence on me as well. I really appreciated, you know, you had quite a few zinger quotes in there for sure during the talk today, but you said something, I think I caught it, which was forests precede us and deserts nip our heels. Is that what you had said?
I say deserts dog our heels. But
dog our heels. I'm curious where that quote comes from, and if you could just expand on that a little bit. Cause it was...
You know, it's one of those quotes that I keep thinking I said first, but I think I stole it from somebody. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, Lierre, but do you know who did that quote?
She's muted.
Well, in any case, I may have just modified a word or two. I probably said dog our heels. Somebody else probably said, like you said, nip our heels or something.
If someone says maybe Thomas Berry.
I think that if it is by somebody besides me, I think it's somebody way older. I think it might be like, you know, I don't know, Aristotle or somebody. I don't know who. It's not an uncommon observation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, for me, it was very resonant in that it kind of created a sort of cyclical, framing, whereas, you know, often we get sort of in the trap of thinking that history is linear, right, or always going towards progress or regress or whatever it may be. But to me that was very resonant in that it was sort of a cyclical thing between the forests and the deserts and back again. And just this morning I was reading about the possibility that, you know, we should maybe switch talking about Western drought to talking about actual desertification, because it seems to be not necessarily a temporary phenomenon, but something that's a full blown, you know, habitat transformation. So I thought that was very interesting. Looks like Diana has her hand up. Diana, do you want to go ahead and unmute?
Hey there, Liz. Thank you. And Gay and Derek, what a lively, powerful, insightful conversation. Thank you both. I had one, actually, a number of questions, but I'm just going to keep it to this one. When we had that big wave of heat here in the Pacific Northwest a couple of weeks ago, a number of people I knew kind of fled to places that were cooler. And so it kind of made me think of like kind of the human privilege of being able to just go to different places when the climate doesn't sustain us as well. And we have an apartment here in Portland and feed the birds and kind of give them water and take care of who comes by. And I felt this just deep responsibility to stay and take care of them because we did this. So help where we can. And I guess my question is not that that's the end all mindset. I think we can continue to do better. But Derek, do you think that that's something that is teachable, worthwhile to be teachable when it comes to worldview and culture and humanity? Or do we just feed the non-humans and like wait for humanity to just fade out?
wait. So do you think it is something teachable? What is the it?
I think that it is a shift in mindset where humans, as Gay kind of speaks to, pulls back from feeling like we lead the way in sentience or superiority to other species, if that mindset of allowing other species to have more space, have more room, and help them is actually something that can be shared and taught amongst the communities to which you say that we would eventually exist in.
I guess two answers. One is, I think it's on a personal level totally teachable. The problem is that the counter propaganda is really overwhelming and constant and incessant is the word I would use. But yeah, I think it absolutely can be taught. You know, I learned a lot from my mom, and my mom was the one with the first relationship with the bears. Oh, I want to tell you this bear story. So my mom had a relationship with this one bear we called Mama, who was the original one who started this whole relationship with bears, that she got dropped off by her mother at my mom's house, and somehow my mom kept trying to chase her away because she thought that's what you're supposed to do. And my mom got out stubborned by the bear, which, if you knew my mom, would. There we go. That's Lear Keith just gave us the answer. Look in chat. Forests precede civilizations and deserts follow them, was said by Francois René de Chateaubriand.
Thank you.
Also, as long as I'm off topic, I also want to just acknowledge the really great work of Cheyenne Olson, who's here too. Anyway, so the bear outstubborned my mom, and eventually they ended up with this really close relationship. My mom could walk out on the porch and say "Yoo-hoo," and the bear would show up. And then I had a couple of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. A few times I was walking the path between my house and my mom's house, and the bear would walk next to me, and I'm not making that up. It was one of the most extraordinary things ever. It was beautiful. Anyway, the bear disappeared, and that's one of the things about wild animals. You never know. They could be dead. Anyway, my mom then got cancer, was dying of cancer, and about 2 weeks before she entered terminal delirium, we had not seen Mama for 7 or 8 years, and Mama showed up on the porch and was just sitting out there. And my mom said, well, either she's telling me I'm going to get better, or she's telling me goodbye. And I said, well, I think she's telling you that things will be okay. Anyway, so my mom taught me a lot about that. And I think that, and I remember I knew a person when I lived in Spokane who was a teacher, and for some, you know, inner city students, or as inner city as you can be in Spokane. And they went to the botanical gardens one day, and all the children ran away screaming from butterflies because they thought they were going to sting them. So there's a, you know, I think that there is a lot one can do. I mean, I know that this is being kind of an ass, but I have been walking down a city street and seen someone intentionally squash a spider on a wall, and I'll stop and say, why'd you do that? I
do the same thing. I do it too.
And I mean, I say it with a smile. It's like, yeah. Hey, why'd you do that? It wasn't bothering you. But it's still, I mean, I feel like a jerk every time I do that. But, I mean, there's a lot to be done. And yes, I think it is teachable. And
why do you feel like you're a jerk when you do that?
Because I don't really like, I just generically don't really like getting in other people's business, even though they actually got in the spider's business. I mean, I fully recognize don't worry, I'm not going to stop doing it. It's just, I feel a little bit weird accosting somebody I don't know. I do that. And I think it is important to teach. And I think But you staying and taking care of the animals is a really good thing. You know, this is something I think about a lot, is that, you know, the current global warming situation, something I don't see talked about in terms of extinction that is much worse than any previous global warming situation, is animals had free paths to flee previous to this, that they only had to outrace global warming to go north. They didn't have to cross highways when they did it, and they didn't have to cross cities. There weren't such things. They just had to keep traveling north and south as fast as they could. And even without global warming, I mean, they're completely screwed. I mean, global warming is not even the number one cause of biodiversity crash. It's like number six or seven. I think habitat loss is number one. Anyway, no, I think it's really important that, you know, and you remind me of a line too, where, an exchange between Wallace Stegner and Terry Tempest Williams, where, how did it go? Something like Terry Tempest Williams said to Wallace Stegner, you know, thank you for going out into the world. And Wallace Stegner said to her, thank you for staying in Utah. You know, there is something important about staying in place. And absolutely, you know, no matter whether you're in, even in New York City. So I wrote a book called Thought to Exist in the Wild. It was about zoos. It was against zoos. And one of the arguments for zoos is that children need to see non-humans. Well, no. Children do need to see non-humans. Yeah. It's just they don't need to see them in zoos. Because if they see them in zoos, that's teaching them that you can take a wolverine out of habitat and still have a wolverine. And it's, you know, as well as harming the animals themselves, of course, it's also teaching them that the wolverine is a bag of DNA in a sack of fur. I mean, it's DNA in a sack of fur, and is not the smell of the high country. Anyway, the point is, when I was writing that book, I thought I'm going to go to the least hospitable place for wildlife in town and see what I can see. So I went to the McDonald's parking lot, and within 5 seconds, I saw a half dozen seagulls, a whole bunch of bumblebees, and some mosquitoes. And, I mean, that is wild nature too. And where I go to in the book is, if you want to see a bear, and if you want your child to see a bear, then what you need to do is live in such a way that a bear wants to come visit you. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do that, then you don't deserve to see a bear. So yes, I think absolutely take care of them.
Thanks.
Thank you. It looks like we have a question from DG in the chat box, which is, are there any leads on Horton? I'm not sure who Horton is. DG, did you want to expand on that?
The only thing I can think of is I don't know if he has or has not yet heard of who.
That's kind of what I was thinking too. Okay, well, DG, feel free to expand upon your question if you feel so moved. Was there anyone else who? Oh, Corey, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Am I unmuted?
Yep.
I just want to go back to the trauma thing, if I may. Absolutely, the environment, the world is in a state of trauma. But I think, from my understanding, it's like our humans were acting out of a state of trauma. I mean, we ignore the horrors, like the guy who wouldn't watch his wife do the cocaine. That's dissociating from it. We try to control everything. So wouldn't a good approach being educating people, and the only way to be safe is to be more a part of things rather than be separate and trying to control them, to sort of relieve our trauma first, and then so we are not continuing our disseminating of these traumatic things onto the rest of the world?
I completely agree with you that we collectively, I think much of our philosophy, behavior, whatever you want to say, whatever you want to point to, is a result of trauma. And and a justification for trauma. And, you know, one of the things, I interviewed Judith Herman decades ago, one of the most important interviews I ever did. She wrote Trauma and Recovery and really came up, she and some other people came up with the concept of complex post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD would be if you're traumatized once. Complex PTSD is if you're raised in abuse or if you're held as a prisoner, long-term repeated abuse. And one of the things that can do is it can cause you to believe that all relationships are hierarchical and that the strong do as they will and the weak get by as they can. And that's completely understandable in the context of a traumatic relationship. But the interesting thing is that perfectly describes the selfish gene. That perfectly describes the great chain of being. That perfectly describes all of our relationship with non-humans. Oh, and by the way, I want to say something about this teachable stuff too, is that, back to the last question, that we're taught all the time that the reason that we have to not help bears is because if we help the bears may learn to become not afraid of humans, and this is bad. Why? And I just take that back to put it in terms of humans. It's like, if I live in Nazi Germany in 1939, am I supposed to not be nice to Jews because then they'll learn to not be afraid of all Germans? I mean, it's just nuts. And besides which, bears are smart enough that they can tell one person from another. Anyway, back to the trauma. Yes, I think that I think it is not really possible to understand the actions of this culture without understanding the effects of trauma on the individual and the community. And I think it is crucial. It is extremely important. I'll say that to any work we want to do to make things better for non-humans, to understand this role of trauma. And I think that at the same time, we can't wait for people to metabolize their trauma collectively and individually before we do things ourselves to, and I know you weren't saying that. And then another thing I want to mention is I'm friends with Chris Hedges, and I've had some really interesting conversations about violence. Both he and I have been traumatized, him through war and me through abuse as a child. And we have come to some disparate conclusions for which we each have absolute respect for the other's position. His primary conclusion is that violence does terrible things to people, and he has lost so many friends to war that he is, I'm not going to say he's less militant than I am. He is more fervent in his search for means that don't involve militants. And I completely respect that. I like it. I have no problem with it. My concern, what I bring to this discussion, is the understanding that perpetrators of severe abuse are insatiable. And you can talk, but the problems are not fundamentally rational and therefore are not amenable to rational solution. And I mean, batterers have such a high rate of recidivism that the government of the UK stopped putting money into programs to get batterers to change and instead gave the same money to domestic violence shelters. And so this gives me great pause in terms of the future, that I think, and I see this in my own family, that I have worked really, really hard to metabolize as much trauma as I can of my own trauma and to turn it into a what Judith Herman and Robert J. Lifton would call a survivor mission. And I see other members of my family, some other members of my family, not all, who've not done that incredibly difficult work and are, I mean, there's the line from the Bible. What is it? The sins of the fathers are passed on to the children for seven generations. I mean, that's because a lot of people don't do that incredibly hard, disruptive work of trying to do it. And I don't see, collectively, I don't see a chance in hell of it happening. And one more thing I want to bring to this is Peggy Reeve Sanday talked about the characteristics. She studied cultures cross-culturally, why some cultures are high rape and some cultures are low rape. And what she found is some commonalities, many of which made common sense. In high rape cultures, women are probably treated more poorly. They are, children are treated poorly. They're a lot more warlike. Low rape cultures, women are treated better. Interestingly enough, high rape cultures are more likely to have a male creator deity, which is really weird when you think about it. Low rape cultures will probably have a female or a couple creator deity. But the thing I want to get to that I found most interesting was that high rape cultures often have a history of ecological dislocation in the previous 300 years. Two things about that. One, okay, that's what she says. I'm extrapolating from there. One extrapolation is when a society gets stressed, men take it out on women oftentimes. But the other one's the one I want to really get to, which is that it takes 300 years to metabolize a trauma socially, not personally. It takes 300 years for the stories to change. And so when people tell me, oh, like this was a Bioneers tagline one year, the shift is hitting the fan, it's like, that's not how social change works. It doesn't happen like that. It happens through slow changing of stories of generation after generation doing work. And environmentally, you know, we don't have the time for people to work through their trauma and to learn to not hate nature and to dump the biblical notion that we have dominion and to dump the biblical notion that all the creatures of the land and the sea should fear us. You know, I'm not saying we shouldn't do that work. It's incredibly important. And for God's sake, I'm a writer. I'm trying to do that work. All I'm saying is I'm also realistic in that there are social rewards for going different directions. And there are large historical forces at work that take a long time to change. And yes, we need to do everything we can on every level at every moment to change, including confronting people, you know, who are killing spiders or wolves. That question down below was about Horton was really a typo, and it was about wolves. And I interviewed Michelle Lute about what's going on in Idaho right now about wolves. And I've done a bunch of interviews about wolves. And it's something I find really, you know, I've lived in the West my whole life. And something I find both fascinating and horrifying is that in India, king cobras kill, and I'm making up the number, it's like 50,000 people a year, 25, a lot of people, a ton of people are killed by king cobras. And I interviewed a guy about, he does work to reduce the number of snake bites. And his work consists mainly of telling people to wear Wellingtons when they go out in the fields, or telling them to keep their bed off the floor so that the snake won't get in the bed. And I said, look, they're killing a lot of people. Do you have to face hatred of these snakes? Because I grew up in the Western United States, and people hate wolves here generally. They just hate them. I don't really understand the rabidity, intentional word use, how rabid they are about their hatred. And he said, no, actually, they love snakes. It really is just a technical question of getting them to wear boots or getting them to take a flashlight outside if they go outside at night. And it's purely technical. And I just am continually stunned by how much we collectively hate nature. And this, you know, people, I see bears every day. There's right now, I can hear a bear on the porch. I know who it is. It's a mother bear. And I know who it is, and I'm not afraid of them at all. There's one bear right now whose behavior is a little bit erratic, who makes me a little bit nervous, but I'm not afraid of bears. I understand that there's only one person dies in North America every 2 years from a bear attack. And there are meanwhile 30,000 or 35,000 Americans die every year in, automobile accidents. So the truth is we should walk through a parking lot going, oh my God, this is terrifying. But people will say, oh my gosh, aren't you scared of bears? Like, no, not at all. And one day, it was the weirdest thing. I was walking down I was walking through forest, and this animal walked up next to me, and it wasn't a wolf, but it was pretty clearly a wolf-dog mix. And it walked next to me for like 20, 30 feet and then went on its way. And the experience, and I love dogs. There's a dog sleeping right here and a dog sleeping right there. But this experience of having this wolf dog walk next to me was entirely different in that there wasn't the hierarchy at all that I experienced with a dog. I mean, it's like, you know, if I'm not going to say it, 'cause then the dogs will wake up. It's like, you know, come here, you know, something. And the dogs will come. This was clearly, it was just this most amazing, extraordinary experience of having this other creature go, I am choosing to walk with you for a minute, and it doesn't matter what you say to me. And
maybe that's the kind of the thread that also that you were bringing in was this horizontality, this notion of, you know, relinquishing this human privilege and all. So I'm sorry, we have to finish up because we have to use this computer for another purpose.
Well, this is really fun. If you ever want to do it again, I'm happy to.
But I hope you can join us again and talk more about the bears and other things and your other books.
Yeah, I would love to.
Please do. Yeah,
and I want to interview you again, Gay, about your work.
Okay. I always have lots to say.
Thank you so much for you, Derek, as well as everyone for being here. I mean, I know that your time is precious and unsustainable as this habitat is. It has been wonderful for this fruitful discussion. So I do appreciate it.